The Guardian.
Hello Sport, welcome to issue 6 of Andy Zaltzman's Summer of Sport, the everything apart from football audio sportscast, that in its short existence so far has provoked the most momentous vote in British history, the downfall of a Prime Minister, the end and beginning of the political careers of Boris Johnson and Boris Johnson respectively, and the first British men's singles victory at Wimbledon for three long, long painful years. That is the kind of influence this show wields. This week I'm joined by comedian Andy Parsons and The Guardian's Emma John. But first, the sports headlines. Michael Gove has been sacked. It's not technically sport, but it's just nice to be able to say it. In other news, at the US Olympic trials, Aries Merritt, the Olympic 110-metre hurdles champion and world record holder, who had a kidney transplant last year following 2 years of illness, will not be defending his title in Rio after missing out on qualification at the US trials by 100th of a second. Come on! Cut the guy some slack, America. He had a kidney transplant less than a year ago. That has to be worth at least 200th of a second. Surely one of the two spoiled sports who finished second and third, spoiling potentially one of the great sporting stories of our times, that's Ronnie Ash and Jeff Porter, can now do the decent thing and just pick up a convenient little dropping a jar of mayonnaise on the foot injury. Let Merritt defend his title. Forbes magazine has published its annual list of the world's richest sports franchises. The Dallas Cowboys lead the way, one of the 27 American football teams in the top 50. The Cowboys worth a tidy $4 billion. That's around £3 billion. Sorry, £3.4 billion. I wrote that joke a few days ago before everything was fine again. Surprise entries in the top 50 amongst the American franchises and the giants of European football. 24th is the Monaco and District Formula One Drivers Amateur Croquet and Tiddlywinks Club. And at 7th, Warren Buffett. He just thought about tennis for 30 seconds, instantly catapulting himself into the top 10.
Golf!
Time now to talk about golf. So I'm joined by, as I said, Andy Parsons and Emma John. Hello, and welcome, Andy, for the first time. Emma, welcome back to the show. A heroic return after your triumphant performance in the first show.
Thanks very much.
It's golf's Open Championship this week. Now, Andy Parsons, you're a big golf fan. What does the Open mean to you in terms of structuring your sport-watching summer? Where does the Open fit into it?
Well, it sort of ran the four majors. I don't really follow golf much apart from that. That and the Ryder Cup. Certainly got no interest in the Olympics at all.
Right. Well, you appear to be fitting right into the general attitudes of men's golf.
Yeah, you and Rory McIlroy.
Me and Jordan Spieth and virtually the entire top four of the golfing fraternity.
Yeah. I like the way, Emma, that they've all picked on the Zika virus as an excuse.
As an excuse to not be there?
Yeah, rather than being a bit more... I'm just disappointed they're not a bit more creative with, just say, the dog ate my clubs or something.
I like the way that McIlroy said, I'm not going because of the Zika virus, I'm all worried about it. And then apparently it's in 64 countries, the Zika virus, including Barbados, where he's just come back from on holiday.
Yeah. I think what he needs to come up with is better excuses of why not to watch it. Because really, I'm going to be watching more important stuff.
Yeah.
That's not going to go down well.
Did you see what he named as more important? Diving. Diving was more important than the golf.
But yeah. I'm absolutely with him on that. I mean, this is...
The only thing you watch the diving for is to watch them muck it up as they do the triple pike off the 10 metres and then to see where exactly you can see a red mark on their body.
That is so true. I actually was chatting to Simon Barnes, the eminent sports writer, the other day. We both covered diving at 2012. And he gave me a really good piece of advice because I'd said to him, I got sent to cover the diving at the London Olympics, watching Tom Daley win a medal, having never covered diving before. And he said, Emma, you don't actually even need to watch the dive. You can have your eyes closed. All you've got to do is listen for whether there's a splash or not. I thought, right, okay, blindfold journalism.
What they're trying to do beforehand, don't they? They give you a little list of what they're about to do.
Yeah.
So if it's just a... You know, it's beautiful, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean, if there's no noise at all, then, either something's gone very wrong
he's
or very, very right.
He's got very scared at the top of the board.
Do you know what I mean? Diving, I guess McIlroy's point was that the Olympics should be the pinnacle of sport. A lot of people have made the same. I thought it was quite refreshing that Someone just laid it out there, just said basically exactly what he thought, that golf should not be there. What's interesting, though, is that no woman golfer has pulled out. Presumably, I don't know, I mean, if Zika is a very sexist virus that only attacks male golfers to try and, you know, redress the balance of thousands of years of gender inequality in the world.
It's because the Olympics will actually bring women golfers into the limelight in a way that they just don't get that kind of coverage when they do brilliant things at the majors, isn't it? That's why.
Yes.
Because that's the irony, will be that they will come to the Olympics and people will actually know their names for the first time.
And it does rather highlight the fact that the Zika virus is just an excuse.
It is just an excuse.
But the Zika virus as well, isn't it? They were saying that actually the golfers have, you know, compared to other sports, less chance because it's, you know, it's a coastal thing, so there'll be less mosquitoes. The people around stagnant water are the ones who are most likely to have any problems with mosquitoes. So they were saying the sailing people, presumably also the triathlon, and perhaps even the steeplechase as they go around the course, you know, trying not to put their foot in the little water jump just to make sure they don't get a little nip on the ankle.
Yeah. So it's, I can't, do you think, I think golf's missed a big opportunity, Andy, in terms of doing something different at the Olympics. And we touched on this in the show a few weeks ago, but just going for a straight four-day stroke play tournament like they have the whole of the rest of the year. Do you not think they could have gone for, you know, some form of either a match play or a mixed team tournament or something that would be a bit different, or speed golf or...
A little windmill, are you thinking, you know, just to get things
the going? Windmill, everyone would watch... Yeah, a genuine windmill on a golf
course. Well, it's interesting because we're talking about Royal Troon coming up for the Open, and there they've got a hole called the Railway Line, haven't they, or the Railway, and it's basically on the side of a railway line. Then you've got the Road Hole at St Andrews. Back in the 19th century when they were designing the courses, they liked a bit of crazy golf. we just got too boring now.
I mean, the big questions, of course, could this be the year that Colin Montgomery finally breaks his major duck? Let me answer that for you, no. And how will golf respond after the refusal of many of the world's top track athletes refusing to come to Scotland and sprint up the 18th fairway on Sunday afternoon due to fears of catching heart disease? works both ways, these things. Now, clearly this is a, you know, very serious sports punditry show, this, so we need to... We like to predict what's going to happen. In golf, I don't think you can predict in golf. It's too random. I think
which
you have
way
to
is
guess.
The wind going to blow, isn't it? That's the big question.
Yeah.
Is it away from the Queen's face? Or is
it... I mean, it's one of the few sports where you get proper rank outsiders coming from... I think the last time I had it at Troon, it was Todd Hamilton, wasn't it, who... I think was just he was.
Yeah, there's only so much of a rank outsider you can be, isn't there? You know, given that there's only 120 people playing.
Yeah, but still, he was 300-1. I think he was just inter-railing and, you know, happened to pitch up and play. They had Ben Curtis the year he won it. He'd never played golf before, I think. But you get these random results that don't. I mean, it certainly doesn't happen in tennis.
And also, and you can have the meltdown with like two holes to go when they put it into the water and then decide to take their shoes off and still try.
Yes.
Those are often the best moments, I think,
they
in
are
sport,
good, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if Jon van der Velde had won that Open, was it 99? I think at Carnoustie.
I'm going to say yes.
Let's say yes to that. I mean, who would people say, oh, yeah, he's the guy that won the Open. But he carved himself a place in global sporting immortality.
And he didn't care if there was any little mosquitoes hanging around that bit of stagnant water.
Absolutely not.
Certainly didn't.
Golf has changed. It's lost its edge.
So we've got to go for prediction. Is this what you want from us?
Yeah, I want a prediction.
Well, I'm going to go with Henrik Stenson, mainly because he had my favourite comment on the Zika virus. And he said, I'm not so much worried about mosquitoes, I'm more worried about bears.
And has he pulled out because of the bears?
No,
or not?
He's not. He's checked out. Apparently, Rio not big on bears, so he's going. But rather than be worried about either mosquitoes or bears, I'd be more worried when you turn up at the airport and you see all the policemen there with a big banner going, welcome to hell, you are not safe. I think if you wanted to pull out for any reasons apart from, you know, say you wanted to concentrate on the four majors, you don't have to go for the Zika virus. Go for the fact that the police haven't been paid for a year and are saying it's welcome to hell.
Laura Massaro, the squash player, was very vocal in her complaints about golfers pulling out the Olympics, because, you know, squash is a sport that really deserves to be in the Olympics. It would be a massive thing getting an Olympic isn't the medal, point about, for example.
Isn't the point about the golf is that tennis was much the same. They didn't take tennis that seriously when it first got in there. And then because people had a great time and all of the top stars now go, Murray says it's one of the best things that ever happened to him. He'll be going back out, blah, blah, blah. I reckon the same will happen with golf in Tokyo, that you will get the top stars going to Tokyo and it will take off.
It's possible, I think. I would still rather have a sport like squash in there, where it would be instantly the pinnacle of that.
I like the idea that it's a training ground. I mean, that's what it was for Murray, wasn't it? It's like the it's like the kind of what? It's like the
British
like
people
the
who aren't necessarily guaranteed to get a major, whack them into the Olympics.
Yeah, I think that's what should happen.
Right. Well, that's interesting. What sport would you like to see in that's not there at the moment?
What about bridge?
It is a sport of sorts, isn't it? Because there's lots of kicking under the table, isn't it?
So it's taken so seriously. I think bridge is like, I think this used to be the case in golf, but bridge is now is the other sport where if you cheat, that's it, you're out of the game for good.
Right.
Yeah. There's no second comebacks in bridge.
God, they
you
are
cheat
tough,
at cars, aren't you? You're done.
Andy Zaltzman, Summer of Sport.
And now it's time for our exclusive Summer of Sport compilation of great open golf moments. Now, of course, commentary has come a long way in golf, as this clip from the BBC radio coverage of the 1931 Open shows.
Thank you, Peter. Very insightful.
But here are some of the classic moments when opens have been won and lost.
Here's Arnold Palmer. He puts it, and it rolls slowly towards the hole and into the hole. He'll be pleased with that one.
And Jack is over the putt. Back goes the club. Forward it comes again in that traditional style. Off trickles the ball, and it goes into the hole.
Faldo now. Here comes the putt, and it's in the hole.
And now his Ballesteros of Spain, just off the front edge, about 20 feet away. He doesn't look happy with it, though. Bit of a slope, and of course, the hole really is quite small. And what's he doing now? Oh, he's putting the putter away and getting out the five wood. Yes, straight into the car park, and he will be much more confident of getting it close from there.
Cycling.
So we're joined now by The Guardian's Will Fotheringham, who is, as ever, travelling around France with the arduous job of a Tour de France correspondent. I mean, it's one of the weirdest sporting events in the world for a sort of non-cycling aficionado, this massive, epic challenge. I mean, do the cyclists get, I mean, particularly the guys just in the peloton, do they get bored of it ever? Just, you know, days and days of hundreds of miles of cycling through France?
I don't think they get bored of it. I think they find that the daily stress tells on them, you know, because it's not as simple as getting on your bike and riding from A to B. There's the constant daily grind of, you know, having to leave your hotel at a certain time, having to get to the start at a certain time, go through the same routine day by day. Then there's all the stress out there on the road. I wouldn't say they get bored, but I think it's a daily stressful grind.
Now, Mark Cavendish has had a very good tour so far. The three stage wins, putting him in second place in the all-time list of stage wins. It strikes me, Will, that he has possibly the weirdest job in the world, Mark Cavendish. That, you know, he cycles thousands and thousands of miles, and basically the most important bit seems to be about 15 seconds every few days, and he has to cycle these hundreds of miles to get there.
It's 5 yards, isn't it?
So, I mean, it's quite an odd existence, isn't it?
It is a strange way of looking at it, in the sense that, you know, you're looking at what is essentially, it is an endurance sport, you know, but the decision, you know, the actual decisive thing, the real decisive stuff happens in the, you know, the bit that we see happens in the final sort of 15, 30 seconds. But I mean, Cavendish would argue that actually his job begins a long time before that. He has to make sure, you know, even on a flat stage when you see the peloton rolling along, you think, oh yeah, that looks pretty easy. Well, if you're Cav, you've got to make sure that you're going to get to that finish in the very best shape possible. So you've got to be concentrating all day, you know, that you're in the right shelter, that you're eating correctly, that you're doing all the right things, you're staying behind your teammates. And then, you know, once it gets to about 20K to go, again, you know, you don't really see this because you just, at that point, you see the pack speeding along. Well, what you know, at that point, you're Cavendish, you're constantly making decisions, you know, where am I going to place myself? How am I going to go through this gap? You know, am I going to hold this wheel? Am I going to back off a little bit here? You're making those decisions constantly in the last, in his case, probably in the last 20 or 30 kilometres. So what we see is that 15 seconds when he comes off, you know, whoever's Marcel Kittel's wheel, say, and wins the stage. What we don't really appreciate is the, you know, the hours of work that have gone into that.
Will, thanks very much for your insight into this.
No, my pleasure.
Fascinating,
my pleasure.
Captivating event. And quickly, can you give us a prediction for the winner?
On paper, Froome is looking very good, but I have a sneaking suspicion that Quintana is sitting there, biding his time, waiting for the last week. And in the last, the two times that Froome has won before, he's faded a little bit towards the end of the last week. And I just have the sneaking feeling that Quintana will, at some point, stage something dramatic next week. I'm quite prepared to be proved wrong, mind.
Couple of other Tour de France items. 2016, of course, the International Year of Pulses, and one of Froome's major rivals, the Ecuadorian-Russian cyclist Pancho Oglobogrobov, is helping raise awareness by carrying a basket full of lentils with him all the way around France. He's riding, of course, for the controversially sponsored Napalm Pokemon Kalashnikov team. It's a real crowd favourite now, Oglobogrobov, trying to become the first man to win a stage of the Tour with a string of onions around his neck since Georges Pulmier on Stage 8 in 1910. That would put him right in the forefront to become the first non-French rider to wear the coveted blue and white striped jersey awarded to the Frenchiest rider in the race. And this, just coming in from the UCI, admits worries that team's technology is starting to dominate the sport and render obsolete more traditional core Tour de France skills, such as reading a big map while cycling down a mountain at 60 miles an hour, competing a stage in a competitive time, having found also found time for a three-course lunch and a couple of bottles of wine with someone else's wife along the way, and syringe disposal. Next year's Tour is set to do away with teams and stages and instead just make riders send a postcard from 25 different specified towns in France to a PO box on the Champs-Élysées. First one back to Paris to arrange all his postcards into chronological order is the winner. Same format as the 1913 Tour, of course, racked by controversy after Alphonse three-time striped jersey winner, of course, claimed victory, but a graphologist detected 25 different types of handwriting on his postcards. So his winning time of 25 minutes now comes with an asterisk next to it in the record books.
Cricket.
Well, you mentioned cheating in bridge, Emma, and people never being forgiven for it. At Lourdes, as we speak, Mohamed Amir is, well, kind of making his return to the Test Arena. Pakistan are batting on the first day, 76 for two at lunch, so he's sort of sitting up there passively. It seems to have split opinion in cricket, the return of Amir. You know, there's a majority that thinks it's done. And we should be pleased to have him back. What's
yes,
yours?
Well, absolutely, because you're right, it's split opinion, but one of the people on the side of don't ever bring him, don't let him come back is Kevin Peterson. And who wants to be on, have the same opinion as Kevin Peterson on anything?
He's almost certainly on the same side as Piers Morgan then, so it's a very good idea not to be
just,
on that side.
You know, just come to our side. I mean, honestly, do you know what? The world is in enough, what is the nice word to say? Poo. The world is in enough trouble at the moment. Like,
it's
I think,
hanging out with Ban Ki-moon this
year. Trying to find a nice way of saying we're all in the crap.
Yeah.
Crap? Is that a bad word? I don't know.
You've just been appointed as an advisor to Boris Johnson, haven't you?
We're all in the shitter. But yeah, if you've been given a punishment and your punishment is X, you shouldn't have to do X plus 2 years before you're allowed back.
Absolutely. And, you know, the ICC decided that was the right thing. And, you know, the courts decided that he had an actual custodial sentence. Well, I think, do you know what? The guy's been through enough. And I just think it's time for a bit of forgiveness, bit of mercy. Let's have a good news story this week. Let's have some redemption.
And, you know, obviously everybody's full of forgiveness, including Alistair Cook, who said, yes, he should expect a bit of abuse when he returns to Lourdes. So we look forward to when he does start bowling and the umpire not shouting no ball, but the entire Barmy army, every ball, yes, doing it at the top of their voice.
That didn't really help calm the traditionally troubled waters between England and Pakistan. But I guess, you know, maybe he'll be booed. I mean, after we are still booing Australians after crimes their ancestors committed 200 years ago.
But it's funny. So. The difference is it's funny to boo Australians. It is funny to boo David Warner. I don't think it's funny to boo somebody who's been to prison. Don't think it's funny.
Well, I probably, if I was sat in the crowd, the chances are, and people shout no ball. I was in Australia when Brett Lee never get found for a suspect action, did he? But everybody was slightly worried that he didn't keep his arm as straight as he might have done. The Barmy Army never tired of shouting no ball at him, even as he was taking like five for a handful at the Melbourne Cricket Ground. And to be fair, after you've had a few beers, it got funny again. It sort of stopped being funny, and then it came about 4 o'clock. You go, no, it is quite good again.
It's quite funny. Do you know what? I think it will happen, but also I think Amir's going to take wickets. I really do. I believe that. Putting my neck on the line here, right. But I think he's going to take quite a few wickets this...
And he's the type of bowler that Cook has sometimes struggled with.
I think Cook's going to struggle.
Really, really good one.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of batsmen do struggle with really, really good bowlers.
Yeah. It's,
there would be a real irony, wouldn't it, if he took a wicket and he no-balled at the same time. That would be a beautiful irony, that would be.
Yes.
Would Cook be reprieved.
Yeah. I think Cook will struggle with him. I think Balance is going to struggle with him. I think it's going to be really interesting. But I think he will redeem himself by just putting in a good performance. And then it all, you know, the birds will sing. People will be happy.
And we'll be no longer in the poo.
It'll be a message of hope for this troubled planet. Now, Theresa May, who I believe, I mean, it's kind of hard to tell this. I think she is still Prime Minister. We have been recording now for about 30 or 40 minutes without any news updates. Ben, can you confirm May is still... there's been no major resignations. But she's apparently a big cricket fan, which, you know, wouldn't necessarily have... I've actually got like a cheeky little Ian Botham tattoo somewhere that we don't know about. I don't know.
And she's named Geoffrey Boycott as her favourite ever cricketer, and the second favourite ever cricketer, a bloke called Tony Gray, who apparently used to play for Surrey.
Yeah, West Indian fast bowler.
That's right.
Yeah.
And but I was wondering whether she was actually that into cricket, or whether she just was trying to search around for two cricketers' names, was going for Tony Gregg, couldn't quite remember his name, and picked somebody from the Surrey, from the 1980s Surrey squad.
Yeah. That's you would not have expected Theresa May's second favourite cricketer to be Tony Gray.
You know, given if that is the case, she does obviously know a fair amount of cricket.
Yeah, yeah.
So
fair play to her.
Well, I've never seen her. You know, she's too busy working. Obviously, you know, she's got to get the job done, and it takes her longer than most.
Also, if she does have time to pop to Lords this week, you know, and as Prime Minister, you know, they ought to be inviting her into the pavilion. I can tell her for now, those leopard print shoes are not going to go down well in the pavilion.
The old parquet floor or whatever in the long room, it's not going to go well, is it?
You know, they'll let her in, but those white coated stewards, they will wince.
Strap in, it's Andy Zaltzman, Summer of Sport.
Now it's time for episode one of our Great Olympic Moments series. And this we go back to Mexico 1968 and the famous long jump. Very generous of the BBC to give us their official footage from this, commentated by Poulton Grampath. And with him in the commentary box was His Royal Highness, the Duke of Nantwich.
To Mexico City, and this is the first round of the jump in the sandpit thing, the long jump. That's it. And yes, there's Britain, Slim Davies, defending champion, of course. And your lordship, Davies will be looking to jump as far as possible today.
Yes, Poulton, he certainly will be. I like to shoot pheasants, and I do not like the food here.
And here is the young American Bob Beeman, and he's running up now in the first round towards that sandpit, and he jumps in the air. And he lands in the pit. Well, your lordship, I'm not an expert in these things, but that looked like a fuck of a long way.
He jumped a fuck of a long way there. I want some brandy now. Why am I here? It's hot and I do not like it.
Truly historically from young Beeman, and, it looks like he's jumped the fuck out of that one. Shit, I had 20 grand on Davis. Shit.
Can I ever tell you about what happened on that canoeing trip in Bolivia with Princess Margaret? Bloody hell.
Tennis!
It would be remiss not to reflect on Andy Murray's superb second Wimbledon title. It was an almost flawless performance.
Easy. It was easy. And then to land the Prime Minister in it just at the end there, so as the Prime Minister gets booed at Wimbledon, the poshest place in the world. He is not going to another sporting venue because he knows he's getting stuff chucked him. If you get booed at Wimbledon, yeah, you're in trouble.
And also, I just love the fact that Murray just looked confused. He did not see that coming, did he? He couldn't believe that that had happened and that...
Well, he thought, you know, he was trying to get in with the English crowd by liking their Prime Minister, at which point all of the English crowd were well over their Prime Minister, knowing that he was on his way.
And also, Nicola Sturgeon was there. She must have felt very left out. Nobody booed her.
Yeah, but then the last time he won it, Alex Salmond was there and got out a saltire, basically trying to hijack Murray's...
Behind Cameron Ted, didn't he? Started waving
Wimbledon
it behind Cameron.
Trying to make a point about Scottish nationalism.
Yeah, photobombing.
There's a
the
time
Wimbledon
and a place, Mr. Salmond. And because Murray had that, well, it was 40 love up and two sets up in that first final against Djokovic. And he must have looked up and seen Salmond and Cameron in the royal box and thought, I don't want any of these bastards sharing my glory. He must have been tempted just to tank it from there. Just to have double faults for the next 2 hours until he lost. Proved I can do it. But
this time, you know, Lendl first time round, you know, impassive, wasn't he? This time a little tear.
He said it was hay fever.
He did say it was hay fever. But the thing was, I saw him welling up. I was welling up at home.
Oh my goodness, I was practically sobbing. To be honest, that is now going to go down with like first 10 minutes of Up. Have you ever watched the film, the Disney film Up? Those two things are going to be equivalent for me now.
I've got a five-year-old kid. I won't show him Up because I watched it with my wife on the plane and we both started crying during that because it both reminded us of our grandparents. So we haven't shown it to him because it's you, isn't it? Yeah. Thinking, how is that film you? This podcast has changed, isn't it?
It really has. So you're comparing Ivan Lendl's tears to the...
Well, no, more Murray's sobbing and
Murray's
not being able to hold it in. I mean, it's really good that those Wimbledon tales are so absorbent, really.
Yes.
That was kind of proof. That's what you'd put in the ad if you were now marketing those tales. That is the clip you'd use to prove how absorbent they are.
Right, that's an interesting angle on it. Well, that brings us towards the end of this week's Summer of Sports. Just time for this week's racing tips. 1. Point it forwards. 2. Don't fall off. 3. Try to get your horse to the front before you cross the finishing line. And 4. Neigh seductively at the other horses in the race. A horny horse is a slow horse. We'll be back next week with more sport. Thanks very much to Emma John and to Andy Parsons. Well, enjoy the rest of the Tour de France. It's such a baffling event. I can't understand. It seems to get... he's got a 15-second lead and with only 11 days to go, that could already be crucial. I don't understand it. I think I will go to my grave not understanding Tour cycling. I'm happy with that. I respect it, but I do not understand it.
Shall we go, Emma?
Let's go.